Glad everybody is. I don't know about you. I am looking forward to the fall season. Summer is okay, but it's too hot and people are everywhere, and I don't love that. I don't love not knowing where anybody is. If they're in Wisconsin. Why are they in Wisconsin? That's what you do. You just travel to random places in the country in the middle of July. That's what everybody does. So I'm glad to see everybody back. School's up and going. Things are back to normal. My routine has returned to its rightful place in my life. And so I'm a routine person. And so I enjoy the school year when everything kind of goes back to a regulated schedule. And so we're going to be back on that. So I appreciate you being here this morning. If you didn't get a handout on the way in, raise your hand. I want to make sure everybody has one. If you didn't get a handout so that we are all on the same page, I think we're good. Very good. Be in Hosea. Turn over to the book of Hosea, chapter 11. Hosea chapter 11, and we are going to do our best to cover this whole chapter today, but it's not particularly long, so I think we will do pretty good. We're getting definitely towards the end of this book. For many of you, you might be on the last pages. For me, my font is a little bigger, so I have to turn once, but we're getting close to the end of this book. Hosea is one of the larger of the minor prophets, and so that's kind of the way that this one is. It takes a little bit of extra time. And in this particular chapter, he uses a different metaphor. While you're turning over there, throughout the book of Proverbs, God gives wisdom, God gives instruction to people in general, and it's often framed, the whole conversation is often framed around a instruction from a father to a son. I give you one passing verse in Proverbs chapter 5, "My son, attend to my wisdom and bow down thine ear to my understanding." And this could be true in two different ways, and they could both be true at the same time. One of them could be that the book of Proverbs is being written from a father to a son, of how to live, how to grow up, how to become an adult, how to be a man. But then another way, there's a sense in which the whole book of Proverbs is written to all of us from God, who is giving wisdom to us as his children of how to grow up, how to make wise decisions, how to make good choices. And this is a metaphor that's used throughout the Bible. Now, the book of Hosea has used a lot of pictures in order to illustrate its point, laying the accusations of sin against the children of Israel and calling them back to himself. He's used as his primary illustration the relationship between a faithful husband and an unfaithful wife. So that's been the governing illustration of this book. But he's also used other ones, like the last couple weeks we talked about the sowing and reaping. So he's gone to the field and talked about putting seeds in the ground and what you get out of it. He's talked about bakery. He's used one of a baker needing to knead his dough and being lazy and not doing it, and the fire gets out of control overnight. So he uses a lot of illustrations. In this chapter, instead of using the illustration of husband and wife, he uses the illustration of father and son. And so I want us to see it today. Let's read the whole chapter as we begin. It's only 12 verses long, and that'll get us situated. Hosea chapter 11, verse number 1. "When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. And as they called them, so they went from them. They sacrificed unto Balaam and burned incense to graven images. I taught Ephraim," Ephraim being the namesake for the northern tribes, "also to go, taking them by their arms, but they knew not that I healed them. I drew them with cords of a man, with bands of love, and I was to them as they that take off the yoke on their jaws, and I laid meat unto them. He shall not return into the land of Egypt, but the Assyrian shall be his king, because they refused to return. And the sword shall abide on his cities, and shall consume his branches, and devour them because of their own counsels. My people are bent to backsliding from me, though they called them to the Most High, none at all would exalt him. How shall I give thee up, Ephraim? How shall I deliver thee, Israel? How shall I make thee as Admah? How shall I set thee as Zeboim? Mine heart is turned within me. My repentings are kindled together. I will not execute the fierceness of mine anger. I will not return to destroy Ephraim. For I am God and not man, the Holy One in the midst of thee. I will not enter into the city. They shall walk after the Lord. He shall roar like a lion. And when he shall roar, then the children shall tremble from the west. They shall tremble as a bird out of Egypt and as a dove out of the land of Assyria, and I will place them in their houses, saith the Lord. Ephraim compasseth me about with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit. But Judah yet ruleth with God and is faithful with the saints. This metaphor of father and child, especially as he uses at the beginning of this chapter, really enables Hosea to go all the way back into their past, into their youth as a nation, and talk about how God raised them to where they were supposed to be. Now, as I was writing this, I was thinking of my own son, and I love my son. I want him to grow up. I want him to be a good kid. I want him to be a good adult. And so I do that by pouring into him, living life with him, getting messy with him, enjoying the things that are important to him because he's important to me. But that also means I have to train him to live well, even when he doesn't understand why something is important. And many, many parents fall on either side of that ditch. Sometimes they'll fall on the side of being companions without being leaders. And sometimes they'll fall on the side of being leaders without being companions. And both tend to have bad results. And so what God shows us here is his willingness to go life along with them through life, but also in a way that guides them to the right steps in their lives. God was concerned about the future of his children, just like parents are concerned about the future of their own children. Now, for Christians, this is an easy application, because throughout the New Testament, the Bible describes God as our Father. It does describe the marriage relationship. We are the bride, and Jesus is the bridegroom. So that's an illustration that's used constantly. But more often than not, we're familiar with the one of Father and Son. We have the privilege of being God's children. 1 John 3 says, "Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called sons of God." And he goes on to describe throughout many of these books about how we have adoption, we have sonship, we have the privilege of what it means to be part of the family. And that means God is our companion, but it also means that he is our leader, and he is to guide us to where we ought to go. So as a father, has God's leadership and guidance in your young and foolish lives been profitable as it ought to have been? And so we're going to look in this passage at five truths about the common experience of God as a loving father. So let's look at number one. Number one, in his love, God has patiently guided his people to a higher life. In his love, God has patiently guided his people to a higher life. Look, go back to the beginning of the chapter. Look at verse number one. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. But just for the sake of saying it, he's not saying I don't love him now. He's just saying about how he had this experience with them when they were kids. I loved him as a kid. I loved him and guided him out of Egypt. Now, this is Israel's youth. This is the conception of them as a nation. This is the beginning of their life. They started out as slaves in Egypt, and he brought them out. In fact, I gave you this passage in Exodus chapter 4 when God's talking to Moses, and he's telling Moses to go into the land of Egypt to bring them out. He calls Israel in that conversation, before he even goes back to get them, he calls Israel his firstborn. And he says, and it's actually very interesting, he says to Moses to tell Pharaoh, "Let my firstborn go, or else I will take your firstborn from you." And of course, that's exactly what has happened in all the plagues of Egypt. That's just a side note. But he imagines this in a very literal way. Go back to Hosea. Look at verse number 3. Hosea chapter 11, verse number 3. "I taught Ephraim also to go, taking them by their arms, but they knew not that I healed them." To go, literally, to walk. I taught them how to walk. And he says, taking them by their arms. This is not supposed to be a spiritual or a deep illustration. This is, we're supposed to picture a dad with his one-year-old holding their hands, helping them walk. I taught them how to walk, holding them up by their arms. So here he says, God to his people, I took their baby steps with them. The first steps of them being my people, the early stages where they didn't know nothing and they were foolish and ignorant about life, I walked slowly with them through those stages. Even though they didn't understand what was really happening, Children don't really understand how much their parents are pouring into them when they do the things that they're doing. And Israel didn't really understand how much grace and mercy they were on the receiving end of when God was there. They knew not that I healed them. I'm going to return to that verse in a second because there's a very vivid illustration there as well. That'll be in point number two. But I want you to look at verse four here in just a second. He actually switches the metaphor from training a child to leading your work animals as well. Look at verse four. I drew them with cords of a man, with bands of love. And I was to them as they that take off the yoke on their jaws, and I laid meat unto them. Several things. He led them with cords, like a rope. Cords of a man. There's a dispute about what he means by that. Some people think he means he did it in a humane way. It's a little bit of a stretch in the Hebrew. But a lot of people believe when he says cords of a man, he's mixing his metaphor with reality. He led them in cords to make the decisions that people have to make. He helped them grow up. We have to make a lot of decisions that come with the territory of being people. You know, there's a lot of people things we have to go through. You have to grow up. You got to go to school. You got to do your homework. You got to, you know, get a job. You got to maintain your property. There's a lot of people things we have to deal with, and God helps us through those. But he's using the picture of leading an animal. He says he does it with bands of love. So he wants you to have two pictures in your mind. One is of a guy who has his animal roped up and he's yanking him down the field, and the other one where there's slack in the cord, right? Where the animal guides because the master is loving, and so he wants to follow him, and the relationship is good. It's mutual, right? With bands of love. He says that he took the yoke off their jaws. It wasn't one that he was yanking them around by the bit, but he allowed it to have some slack so it wasn't as painful. And he bent down to feed them. He gave meat to them. And so here we have this picture of him guiding him with the cord and not making it painful or difficult and giving them food. And so in this beginning, he has two pictures, father and child and a man and his animal. You know what's really interesting? If you ever, I don't do this on purpose, but I have a wife, so every once in a while, you have to endure a chick flick now and again on movie night. It's just part of it, especially during Christmas. Hallmark movies are the worst, aren't they? The girl's engaged to the guy in the city. The guy is too busy in the city, and so he doesn't have time for her, and she has to go be a journalist in some backwater place on the other side of the country. And she's all by herself, but they got snowed in, and she happens to have to stay at the inn of the guy who owns the inn, who's tough and rugged and a lumberjack, and they fall in love for the first 30 minutes, but my fiance doesn't really care about me. And then they get married, and she decides to stay in the country for the rest of her life, and they live happily ever after. Every Hallmark movie ever. Anyway, that has nothing to do with my sermon. It's a little bit of a pet peeve of mine. But the point is, when you watch a chick flick, you end up having this very typical personification of like the perfect man, right? The perfect man is usually, you know, tough and strong and rugged, depending on the context of the movie. If there's war in it or not, he can be violent if he has to be. And then it tends to be that the perfect man, somewhere in the movie, will have this scene where he has to interact with, now follow me, he has to interact with a child or with an animal. And then you see this like tender scene where he cares about his horse, right? You know, or he has this nephew or niece and he's just super kind and gentle and gives a lot of attention. Why do women typically paint men in that way? Tough, rugged, even violent if they have to be, and then soft and gentle when it has to come to things that need care. Because intuitively, we know that there is a balance between those things. And the thing is, God personifies that balance perfectly. Throughout the book of Hosea, he is filled with wrath and anger and even violence against sin. And then, yet, you see him talking to his people in care and kindness and gentleness. And here in this, he pictures it as a father to a child or as somebody who cares about his farm animal well. And you see the balance between those two, because that's who God is to us. He is everything we need on both ends of the spectrum. And he did it. He led them out of Egypt to give them the new life in the promised land. God has been willing to take you by the hand and in the power of the Holy Spirit be your comforter, the one who comes alongside of you, holds your arms up and teaches you to walk. And he's done this because he loves you and wishes the best for you. He does it in his power and he does it in his care. But number two, in rebellion, we often choose the lower life. God leads us to a higher life. In our rebellion, we choose the lower life. What's embedded in all of those verses is that they didn't follow. What's embedded in that beginning is he led them by the hand to walk well, and they didn't walk well. They chose not to acknowledge him. Now, before we get too far into this message, the tendency for all of us in here, especially for those of you who have kids or have had kids for a long time, is once we start talking about father and child and we start talking about how rebellious and how disobedient children are, the response for us is all to nod and be like, yeah, my kids are the worst. You know, they don't listen. But remember, this book is written from Hosea to the people of Israel. And in this illustration, God is the parent and we are the children. The interpretation of this passage is not to dump ourselves in the place of God and picture ourselves as the perfect parent. That's not what we're supposed to be gleaning from. And everybody else as our rebellious children. We're supposed to be reading this passage, putting ourselves in the shoes of the child and realizing how we have been the rebellious children. So before you project this whole message onto your kids, remember that you're supposed to be projecting it onto yourself. All of us are. So I just feel like that needs to go with, needs to be said before we move on. It's our rebellion, not your children's rebellion against you, but our rebellion against God that made us choose a lower life. That's what we're supposed to be taking from this. And so look what he says here. Verse number one, when Israel was a child, I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. And as they called them, so they went from him. Literally, that what that means is, to the extent that they were called is the extent to which they walked away. I told them to come to me, and they chose to go away from me. That's what he's saying here. They sacrificed to Balaam, burned incense to graven images. I taught Ephraim to go, taking them by their hands, but they knew not that I healed them. Here, he begins to refer to several things that we know from the story of the Bible. Right after they got out of Egypt and they were learning to walk as new people, they ended up making all of these decisions where they turned away from God. They sacrificed to Balaam instead of to God. Immediately out of the land of Egypt in Exodus 32, what are they doing? They're sacrificing to a golden calf. What? Right after God describes how to worship him, the next chapter over, we see them worshiping the world. They knew not that God had healed them. This is actually a reference to Exodus chapter 15. When in Exodus chapter 15, and I'm not going to read it, but it's there for you if you want it. In Exodus 15, this is the story right after they get out of the land of Egypt and they go to a little oasis that's supposed to have water because they're thirsty, but it doesn't have fresh water and it has bitter water. And God drops his tree in it and he makes the bitter water sweet. They call the place Marah, Marah meaning bitter. And at the end of that passage, it says, for I'm the Lord that heals thee. But yet they didn't, just like children don't realize all the things that their parents are doing for them, they didn't even realize all the things that God was doing for them. God was taking them by the hands, and they weren't really appreciated. They ignored the God that wanted to raise them. So what happens? Go down to verse number 5. He shall not return into the land of Egypt, but the Assyrian shall be his king. Because they refuse to return. The sword shall abide on his cities and shall consume his branches and devour them because of their own counsels. Now, a few chapters ago, it says that they would return to Egypt, and now he's saying they're not going to return to Egypt. The reason he's saying this is because he's wanting us to see this picture. They were taken out of the world because of God's mercy and grace into a higher life, and now they're choosing to go back to the world. So sometimes they'll say, they were taken out of Egypt, now they're going back to Egypt. So it's an easy picture here. This verse is reminding us, they're not actually going to go to Egypt itself. They're going to go to a different part of the world. They're going to go to Assyria instead. But the reason it says it back and forth that way is because it wants you to see the decision that they're making. They're leaving, they were taken out of the world, now they're returning to the world. And that might mean something different. And that's true for Christians, you know. God takes them out of the world, and then the world still boils in their heart, and they choose to go back to it. 20 years later, it might not look the same, but it is the same. We're still going back to Egypt. even if it's not exactly the same. You might not go back to the same club, but you go back to the same mindset. You might not go to the same friends, they might have moved away, but you go back to the same lifestyle. They didn't necessarily go back to Egypt, but for them, it's going to be Assyria. That's what it's going to look like instead. Different, but the same. And so it is for us. They chose to have the lower life, the degrading, sinful bondage of the world. And what's that going to look like for them? War? Famine? So much for the high life that they were looking for. Because they refused to repent. Because they listened, watch, to their own counsels, he says. Because they trusted their own instincts about what's right and wrong. Now, don't get me wrong. Levi, my son, he's a good kid. But even now, as a two-year-old, and I got to tell you this story. This also doesn't have anything to do with my message, but it's super funny. But even now, as a kid, he will explain to me why what I just said he doesn't have to do. And I don't really feel like he's being rebellious always when he says it. He's just like, that doesn't make sense to me. So, Dad, what if I just don't do that? You know, that's just kind of the way he talks to me. But I got to tell you this story. Two days ago, we were sitting on the floor, and I told Levi to do something. I don't remember what it was. And he said, but, and I said, no, Levi, no buts. No buts, no buts. And he paused, and he thought, and he said, I can't sit on things. That was his reply. I was like, wow, that is a good logical conclusion from that. Anyway, that's not part of my sermon. But Levi, in his foolishness as a two-year-old, still quickly is under the impression that, well, I shouldn't have to do that right now. And you see the wheels turning. It's not all just sin and disobedience, just like, well, that doesn't quite make sense to me, so I think I'll just do this instead. And see, that's what we do, isn't it? We're not like, God, I don't respect your authority. We're just like, you know what, that doesn't really make sense to me, so I'm just going to not do that. And that's how we react. And then we're like, why, God, are you upset with what I'm doing in my life? I tried to be wise. Yeah, you did, but you're, you know, not. So you don't make the right decisions when you follow your own counsels. Remember the last few weeks we talked about their kings and princes? They should be able to handle everything, and then they just didn't. They didn't know what decisions to make, and they were bad. They were all really, really bad, and now they're having the consequences of it. Why? Because they don't know, and neither do we. We don't really know. And so when we look at God and we say what ought not to be in the Bible that is, or what ought to be in the Bible that isn't, or how we ought to be able to raise our kids, or how we ought to be able to use our money, or we ought to be able to use our time. I know what God says, but I'm just going to not do that because that doesn't make sense to me. It's going to cost us. God gives us a higher life, and we're like, what if I just don't do that, and we choose the lower life? And then we wonder why it's not working out for us. Israel failed, but must they have failed? Must we fail? I want you to go back in verse number one. I can't preach this message. I almost did, but I can't preach this message without referring to this. Look at verse 1. When Israel was a child, then I loved him, and I called my son out of Egypt. This verse actually gets quoted in the New Testament in a little bit of a bizarre way. In Matthew chapter 2, this is the story of Jesus being born, and he's raised for a while in Bethlehem, and the wise men come. And they offer gifts to Jesus because he is the king. And then Herod, of course, knows that this new Messiah is born in Bethlehem, so he orders the death of all the children 2 years old and under in Bethlehem. And so somebody warns, an angel warns Joseph to go to Egypt to escape the destruction that Herod's going to bring on these children. And so he does. Later he gets news that Herod is dead, and so it's safe. Because his son is now king, and that he can come back. And Matthew quotes Hosea 11:1. I gave you the passage where it says, being warned, they went to because of Herod, and so they went to Egypt, and then they came back. And at the end of that, it says, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, out of Egypt have I called my son, Hosea 11:1. Very interesting. Why? So Hosea is actually referring to Jesus all along, even though it actually looks nothing like that in Hosea chapter 11. One thing that you'll notice in Matthew's structure of his book is he does something very interesting. And this is important to you, by the way. What Matthew does in his gospel of Jesus is there's two big themes that he does. One is that he pictures Jesus as the king. Hence the reason why instead of him using the story of Jesus being worshipped by the shepherds, which doesn't really make you very, you know, kingly. Yeah, I mean, that just shows how humble you are and that you're willing to reach out to anybody. Matthew chooses to emphasize the story of the prominent people from the other side of the world coming and worshiping him with gifts to show how important Jesus is. So that's a big theme throughout this. The kingdom of heaven is one of the most prominent themes throughout the whole book of Matthew. In the Sermon on the Mount, he talks about how to be members of the kingdom of heaven. You know, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You have the Matthew 13 parables, all about the kingdom of heaven is like unto a pearl that was in a field. So this is very common. Matthew 24 and 25, where he talks about how he will set up his kingdom one day. So the kingness of Jesus in Matthew is very, very prominent. But one other thing Matthew does in his gospel is he pictures Jesus as the perfect Israelite. When all the decisions that they made were bad, Jesus made the right ones. And what Matthew does is he traces some of the same path. So at the very beginning of the book, he is called out of Egypt. That's why he references this. Then, what does he do? He passes through the waters of baptism to begin his ministry. Paul actually compares our baptism into a new life to the Israelites passing through the Red Sea. Then, what does he do? He goes to the wilderness, not for 40 years, but for 40 days, and he is tempted. And all throughout these temptations in the wilderness, he instead quotes things written in the law that the Israelites were supposed to do in the wilderness, but didn't. One of them being about how they were lusting after meat and choosing to tempt God. These are quotations he has. So then he goes to the wilderness. And what's the thing he does after going through the wilderness? He goes up to a mountain and he gives a reiteration of the law to his people. So there's this path that Jesus is walking like the Israelites do, but instead of failing at every turn, he is successful in making the spiritually right decisions at every turn. And there's a sense in which he is our forebear. We can follow in his steps through his help to not have to fail at every turn. Sometimes when we read through the Old Testament, the idea that we get is, therefore there is no possible way to be victorious in these difficult decisions of life. But what Jesus does is he walks the same road victoriously. And then he says, and so in my power you can as well. And so why do I bring all those things out? Well, one, I feel like I can't not reference the fact that that got quoted in Matthew. But it's interesting. He's looking at the Israelites saying, this is the path you took, and it was always wrong. Jesus took that path, and he was right. And we, in his power, can also take that path. We're not destined to fail. We don't have to be rebellious children of God. That's what we do to our kids, isn't it? Well, they're all going to go through a rebellious streak. Do they have to? Are we determining them to fail? There's no way for them to get through their teenage years without being a horrible kid. Like, that's not a possible scenario. And that's what we do to our Christian life. Well, there's no way to me to grow my Christian life without being a horrible failure somewhere along the way. Do we have to? And if we have to, then he wouldn't be condemning us for doing it. But he does, because we can make a different decision in his power. In our rebellion, we choose to a lower life. Now, number three, it's not enjoyable for God to judge those he loves. He reaches back to Israel's history and culture, pulls out the story of Exodus from Egypt. And then he reaches back into their history and culture, and he pulls out another story. One that's not readily obvious, but it's actually definitely 100% what he's referring to here. He reaches back even further into their story, and he pulls out the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. He's already referred to this a couple times in this book, but here he refers to it again. Look at verse number 7. You're not going to see it right away, but it's there. Verse 7. My people are bent to backsliding from me. Though they called them to the Most High, none at all would exalt him. And then he has this grappling moment. How shall I give thee up, Ephraim? How shall I deliver thee, Israel? Which is in a negative way. Not deliver you from evil or wickedness, but deliver you to it. How shall I make thee as Admah? How shall I set thee as Zeboim? Mine heart is turned within me, my repentings are kindled together. So he's asking all these rhetorical questions. How can I just give you up? How can I just turn you over? How can I just hand you off, hand you away? Now, it's true that God always knows what he's doing, and he never makes the wrong decision. It's not like God is indecisive. I gave you a passage, Isaiah chapter 46, declaring the end from the beginning in the ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, I will do all my pleasure. God knows what he's going to do. However, we cannot let that absolute truth steal from the way that Hosea pictures it, of God grappling with this question. Not that he doesn't know the decision, but he wants you to see the tension of the fact that we deserve judgment and God doesn't desire to do it. Because he wants you to recognize his heart isn't looking for the first opportunity to judge. How shall I give you over, Ephraim, he says. And he refers two cities in here, Admah and Zeboim. Now that probably doesn't mean anything to you, but apparently Hosea expects it to. So just a reminder that the Bible expects you to know your Bible well. Because sometimes it just refers to it and is like, because you know, right? You know. And then it moves on. So that this is one of those times. Admah and Zeboim only show up a couple times in the whole Bible. And both times they show up in the Bible, including here, they are connected to Sodom and Gomorrah. In Genesis chapter 14, there's a story of kings rising together in war. There's one group of kings that fight against another group of kings. The reason it's in the Bible is because Abraham gets caught up in the mix, and Abraham and his little shepherd people come in, and they settle the whole thing, and they get all the spoils. But in passing, we notice in Genesis chapter 14 that Sodom and Gomorrah are allied with Admah and Zeboim. Now later, they're referred to. We don't really hear from them again. We all move on. And when we get all the way down to Deuteronomy, do you have that verse, Deuteronomy? He's talking to Israel, and he's talking to them about destruction he brings on sin, and he refers to Sodom and Gomorrah. The whole land thereof is brimstone and salt and burning, that it is not sown, nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. So we always say Sodom and Gomorrah, those are two cities. Apparently, when that happened, several of the other little cities they were allied with them also were destroyed in God's anger and his wrath, including these two little sister cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. I'm not going to read it for a second time because I have to move on. But throughout the prophets, Israel is reminded that whether they think so or not, they're acting like sister cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. They're walking the same path. They're acting like them. I gave you two. One's in Isaiah, one's in Ezekiel. Connects them. You're making the same decisions as Sodom and Gomorrah. You're choosing to be their sister cities. And so just as I overthrew all of them in my anger and my wrath against sin, so you are choosing to walk the same path. And so he throws this story in the middle of here and says, how shall I overthrow them? Just like I did Admah and Zeboim. Remember, I reminded you of Ezekiel 33. God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked. He puts this in here because he wants you to see the grappling that God does. Not because he doesn't know the answer, but because he doesn't like the truth that we deserve judgment. That's not enjoyable to him. It is not more holy to picture God as a stone that doesn't react to the world around us. Not that he makes decisions in real time, but that it doesn't affect him. That's why God is seen as being joyful and as sorrowful, because what we do matters to him. And he doesn't enjoy judgment. But number four, God cannot be close to wickedness without consuming it. God cannot be close to wickedness without consuming it. So while he's referring back to this moment of Sodom and Gomorrah, and apparently also Admah and Zeboim, and they're walking the same path, look what he says. Verse number 9. I will not execute the fierceness of mine anger. I will not return to destroy Ephraim. Why? For I am God, not man, the Holy One in the midst of thee, and I will not enter into the city. in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and apparently Admah and Zeboim also, the angels of God in this story go into the city. They walk into the city. In Genesis chapter 18, the Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sins very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come to me. And if not, I will know. And the next chapter over, they go down into the city. Genesis 19, we will destroy this place because the cry of them is waxing great before the face of the Lord. The Lord hath sent us to destroy it. Their presence in the city was to destroy it. They went to it to destroy it. So in this passage where he says, I will not enter the city, what does he mean by that? He's harking back to this story. By the way, remember what happened right before that? Abraham and God are looking at Sodom. Well, if there's 50 righteous, you won't destroy it. I won't destroy it. If there's 45 righteous, I won't destroy it. If there's 10 righteous, I won't. Goes down into the city, sees the wickedness, and destroys it. So he says, I'm not going to destroy Ephraim right now. I will not go into the city. This is the picture. If God were to come into the city, then it would be destroyed. So here were their two options. Either God's presence was nearby and their wickedness would be consumed by God's holiness, because God is not a man, he is God, the Holy One of Israel. That's in that verse. Or God doesn't destroy the city, which means his presence isn't there. Those were their two options. Remember, God is a consuming fire. That's the two options for Christians. God's presence in your life means that he's going to chastise your wickedness because his presence is a consuming fire, or we don't have his presence at all. Those are your options. And a lot of Christians opt for the second one. We would be just as happy if God left us alone, even if we didn't have him with us, if he didn't bother us. The presence of God is a gift. Remember, all the way at the end of the Bible, God even looks at the door of the church and he says, I stand at the door and knock so that I come in and sup with you and you with me. God wants to be with you. But if there is purposeful, unconfessed wickedness and disagreement and rebellion with God, he responds to it because he is good when we are not. But many of us just move on as if it's not a big deal. There's a story in the life of David. It's a very vivid story. David has become king, even though Saul was the former king. And Saul's family is now at war with David's family because God has chosen David instead of Saul's successor. Now, that war doesn't go well for Saul's family because the leadership was trash, and so it just kind of gets all dissolved. But meanwhile, the rest of Saul's family is worried that David's going to come and overthrow them. However, David's best friend was Jonathan, Saul's son. And so David, in 2 Samuel 9, says, find somebody from Jonathan's family. I just want to be nice to him. I just want to show him kindness. And they find this child who has been crippled because they rushed out of the house quickly, running away from David when he became king because they didn't know what he was going to do. So this cripple comes, and they find him because apparently he'd been hiding out from David this whole time, thinking he was going to, like, destroy him or something. And they bring him to David, and he's all scared, and he says, no, I want to be nice to you. And so he gives him a seat at his table. He gives him a place in the palace. He says that he'll have servants take care of his land, and he'll get the money from it, but he doesn't have to work it. He doesn't do any good to David, but David shows kindness. Fast forward in the story. Much later on in David's reign, his own son, rebels against him, and David leaves town. And a lot of his friends go with him. This guy, this young kid, his name is Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth doesn't go with him. He's a cripple. He really can't make the journey anyway. And eventually the whole thing settles. There's a war, and David wins. David comes back to Jerusalem. And when he comes back to Jerusalem, Mephibosheth comes out of the city to greet David. And the Bible specifies that Mephibosheth hadn't washed his clothes or trimmed his nails or cut his hair since David had been gone. Because he was close to David, and David's absence in his city, David's absence in his life, meant for Mephibosheth he couldn't just go on as normal. Isn't that an interesting picture? Like, for all things, he didn't wash his clothes, he didn't cut his hair. Why? Because he couldn't act like everything was okay, because it wasn't. And Christians are way too accustomed to moving on in life and acting as if everything's normal, even when God's presence isn't in their life. And this verse doesn't scare us as well. Oh, I won't enter into the city. Oh, okay, I'll be fine then. Oh, you're not going to destroy me? Oh, okay, we're okay. No, you're not okay. That shouldn't be as equally scary to us as destruction. We're just as pleased to go on as normal as if everything is okay. And here he says, I might not treat you like Sodom, but I'm also not going to be there either. Later on, a few generations later, when you get to the book of Ezekiel, there's a super sad moment. It's hard to interpret out of the weave of all of the picture, the imagery, but the picture is simple. God's presence leaves the temple. Like, it picks up and it leaves. Like, you're not worshiping me, I'm not living here anymore. And it's after that that the temple's destroyed. You destroyed God's house, not God's house anymore. He wouldn't live in there. Isn't that sad? Well, why would God destroy my life? I'm a Christian. Well, you might not be God's house right now. Because his presence might not be in your life the way that you want it to. It doesn't mean you're not saved. It doesn't mean you lose the Holy Spirit. But God's influence in your life should always be strong. And sometimes we're content with it not being. I got to finish up with this last point. Number 5. God wants rebellious children to come home. This is not just a book of judgment, and I hope you've seen that already, or condemnation. This chapter shows this as well. This is a book of undeserved forgiveness and restoration freely offered to people who don't deserve it, or apparently not even wanting it. Look at verse number 10. They shall walk after the Lord, and he shall roar like a lion, and when he shall roar, then the children shall tremble from the west. This is very similar to a picture he draws in another place in the Bible. Numbers 24 describes God as a lion bringing them up. And so here he says the same thing. They will follow me, and then I will stand guard for them, is this picture. But look at verse 11. They shall tremble as a bird out of Egypt and as a dove out of the land of Assyria, and I will place them in their houses, saith the Lord. A couple chapters ago, he compares Israel to a silly dove that flies wherever they want. Sometimes they'll fly to Egypt or fly to Assyria. Here he's reversing the picture, and they'll be like that dove and fly out of Egypt and out of Assyria and back home to the houses that he's built for them. The story of the prodigal son is profitable here. The son leaves home. The father always welcomes him back home. Now, as he finishes off, we see that they're not doing this. Ephraim, verse 12, compasseth me about with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit. But Judah yet ruleth with God, and he is faithful with the saints. In Hebrew, what he says about Judah is a little bit more ambiguous. It's really difficult to parse out exactly whether or not he's saying they're doing right or they're doing wrong. And throughout the book, Judah's been pictured as doing the wrong thing, following the same footsteps as Israel. And several commentators mention that maybe the mention of Judah is purposely ambiguous because their destiny really could go either way. They could worship God or not. They could be faithful or not. But the point here is simply this. God has had given them the privilege to serve him. As a father who raises his children, teaches them to walk, and as teenagers who often run away and rebel, there's always a path back home for them. And that is true for us as well. God cares about how your life goes. Parents, they care about how their kids turn out. It matters to them whether they're successful or not. It matters to them whether or not their life is what they wanted it to be. It matters. And God, it matters to God for our lives as well. Everyone has the privilege of having a perfect heavenly Father if we choose him. He wants you home, and so let us not be rebellious children taking the low road. Let us find the high road in faith on the way to the blessed life of the promised land that God has designed for us out of his love and out of his mercy and out of his grace. And let us not be like the Israelites who walk away from it so easily.